Again, if you're visiting with us, we want you to know that you're a special welcome guest. I do have a guest this morning. I don't want to embarrass him, but I'd like to introduce Robert Picone. Robert is sitting by Janice over here, and Robert is a really interesting fellow to talk to because he is a retired New York policeman. He was a first responder at 9/11, and so he has lots of images burned into his brain. He is here in this community, been living here for several years, and is now, I guess, working on a second career with the Shenandoah Police Department. And so we're glad to have him. He's a good friend, and we're glad to have him as our guest today. So take the opportunity to meet Robert before you leave. The word covenant in the Bible describes a very special relationship between two parties, a relationship which is wholly exclusive and mutually beneficial. Some number of you fairly recently had a class on covenants, and I know that was a very beneficial class to you. The very first covenant described in the Bible is one between God and his greatest creation, man. He had said, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over it. Behold, I have given you every plant, every tree, every green plant," he says in Genesis 1, 28 through 30. You see, God honored man by giving him everything that he needed. And man, in turn, was to honor God by taking care of this creation that he had created, cultivating the garden and obeying the prohibition against a certain tree in the middle of the garden in Genesis chapter 2, verse 15 through 17. And though this is not called a covenant per se, nor is any name or title given to it, it was a covenant just the same. We might call it a covenant of relationship. And then the second covenant described in the Bible is between a husband and wife. Woman was created for man. Because he was alone, because there was no adequate companion in the animal kingdom. I heard a news blurb this week about young women who bristled at the idea that they, quote, needed a man in their life. And that attitude has had a strong impact on marriage today, and that's being taught, obviously, to our young ladies in so many homes today, that I don't need a man in my life. I can do anything a man can do, and I can do it better. And so our society is reaping the consequences of that and other injustices and false information that we have come to believe today. So perfect and complementary was this arrangement that God made that both the husband and the wife, a man and the woman, could live unashamedly in perfect harmony in the presence of God and in the presence of one another. Moses will write of this event hundreds of years after it happened. And as he looked back and pointed to this wonderful covenant into which God had brought the man and the woman, he wrote, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." And I deliberately used the King James translation there because I like it. I like the distinction that it makes. This is, if you'll allow me, a covenant of companionship. And that's what I'd like to discuss this morning, the fact that marriage is a covenant of companionship, a beautiful thing that God has created for man and woman. It almost seems like God forced Eve into Adam's life, doesn't it, when we read the story. But if we were able to read the New International Sound Effects Version, which, of course, there is no such thing, but if there were such a thing in the Bible, we would hear Adam, when he looked at the woman, say, "Yee-haw." He was from Texas, by the way, but when he got that first look at that woman that God had created, Adam's heart jumped for joy. Man's first experience in the Garden of Eden was a great case study in loneliness. The Bible says that God saw that it was not good for man to be alone. Now, it was the only way that man knew. And you know, you don't know what you're missing if you never had it or if it never existed. And in his wisdom, God commanded Adam to name the animals. And there's more purpose behind it than just getting a name for the animals. It said, "In whatever the man called the living creature, that was its name," in Genesis 2:19. Why would the God of all creation leave such an important task in the hands of mortal man to name these animals? First of all, I believe it's because God needed man to see that he was lonely. And this was going to be a visual illustration of that. And also, he needed to see that there was no animal that could fill that emptiness, that lonely place in his heart. So God paraded all of the animals in front of Adam so that he could find a helper for himself, a companion. But alas, there was no creature. There was nothing in all of creation that was able to be that special companion for Adam. And I always picture God parading, having those animals come before them. And I don't know, he had to have helped him out some. Of course, I suspect that Adam's mind was a lot clearer than ours was through the generations and all the things that have happened. But I can't imagine coming up with all of the names for all of the creatures that existed. But God saw fit to parade those animals in front of Adam in pairs. And as he named them, they would run off in pairs. And so I see Adam's mind at some point. You can see the wheels turning, and he's saying to himself, "Hey, where's my mate?" And maybe it's a bit melodramatic, but I think it accurately draws the picture of what happened. As that very last pair left, Adam is left standing alone. And he feels a very deep sense of loneliness. Everybody has somebody else except him. And so God, knowing that it was not good for man to be alone, realizing that need that man had for companionship, God created a companion for him. And it's really interesting how God did that, isn't it? You all know. But he took something away from Adam. His rib. Now, why a rib? Well, I suspect you've all heard that God did not make a helper from man's foot to be trampled by him, nor did he make a helper from man's head to rule over him, but he made the helper from his side to be brought near him, from under his arm to be protected by him, from near his heart to be loved by him. Now, I have to admit that poetry is beautiful, and many times it is a unique way to get straight to the point. But in all fairness, maybe it didn't really matter where God took the material to make the woman. The important point is that he took something away from Adam. And he was now even more incomplete until he got it back. And later, when God had fashioned a woman from the rib and brought her to the man, and Gabe presented her to the man, now man, for the first time in his entire life, is truly complete the way that God wanted him to be. And he will say, "This is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh," said Adam. Genesis chapter 2, verse 23. She was everything that Adam was not. And he, conversely, was everything that she was not. And together they made each other complete. But the creation of woman was not a creation of convenience, something to be used by man to fulfill temporary feelings of loneliness. Man was expected to make a covenant with this new creature that God had made. And Moses will add to the story, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and his mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." Genesis 2:24. Have you ever asked yourself at the beginning of that, for what cause? For this cause shall a man leave his mother and his father and shall cleave to his wife. For what cause? Well, you have to go back and read the context prior to that, don't you? And the cause that you will come up with is because she made him complete. Because she completed what was missing in him. And only together did they form one body that God intended for a man and a woman to be united in. Punchline. This Bible story brings out a wonderful concept about life. Man does not need to seek out ways to have his needs met. Rather, man is to devote himself to a companion for life. And it is within this devoted, committed relationship that he will find that his needs are being more than adequately met. Moses, instructed by God, explains the requirements of this covenant. For this reason, a man shall leave his mother and his father and cleave to his wife. This covenant involved formally separating, first of all, himself from his parents who raised him. And folks, it don't work if you don't leave. That's the first principle of this covenant. And the second one is, only after this is accomplished can he enter into that covenant successfully with his new wife. Leave and cleave. And the reason that I like that is because the word leave is the same root word that we get the word divorce from. Fully make a break. The word cleave is a word, the Hebrew word, that we get the word glue, G-L-U-E, from. What's the purpose of glue? It's to take two separate objects and to put them together in such a way that now they're one. That's what glue does. It makes one object of two. And so those two things are the requirement for this covenant of companionship that God designed, to leave and to cleave. And this one flesh designation that God said, they will become one flesh. It not only includes sexual intimacy, but it also includes shared outlooks and dreams and hopes. They become one in body and mind and purpose and goal. And it means that they're both totally devoted to the welfare and happiness of another. A young person is often baffled about, how do I know when I'm, quote, in love? Well, let me tell you one of the signs. When what you feel about that other person is a lot more about them than it is about you, it is your desire to make that person happy rather than thinking about how happy that person makes you. That's one of the signs, young person, that you can know that you're truly in love with someone. If it is your primary desire and what you focus on is you want to make that person happy. This union is designed to be so strong that no person and no thing in this entire world can interfere with that relationship. And if we do it the way that God said, if we leave and if we cleave the way that God said for us to, then there is nothing on this earth that can destroy that except the death of one of the partners. Until death do us part, we most often say in our marriage vows, don't we? It sounds almost too good to be true. But God did not present this as some ideal that can't actually be reached. He, in fact, presented it as a factual arrangement for the first couple. And they did, as a matter of fact, enjoy that perfect relationship with one another. And when other couples will pattern their marriages rather than after what we see in our society or in any other society. When we'll go back to the book and we'll pattern our marriages after what we see in the Bible, then we will have this wonderful completeness that God intended for us to experience in our marriages. Let's quickly look at a few universal obstacles to the covenant relationship. I hope to have a number of other lessons in the relatively near future on marriage and home and the family, but this is just kind of a generic on marriage. Some obstacles that people find that interfere with this covenant of companionship. And they're fairly obvious, at least in principle. When one fails to leave and to cleave, then the marriage is not going to work. There is a commandment in the Old Testament that was designed to help a man develop and cultivate his new marriage, this covenant of companionship. In Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 25, the Bible doesn't give it a name, but I give it a name. I call it the honeymoon leave. When a man takes a new wife, he shall not go out to with the army, nor be charged with any duty. He shall be free at home 1 year and give happiness to his wife whom he has taken. A whole year honeymoon leave. You get off of work and you get paid for a whole year when you get married. To devote yourself to getting to know one another. To devote yourself to fulfilling the leaving and the cleaving that's necessary to have a successful relationship. There's nothing more important in a new marriage than to cultivate companionship. A young couple must have time together. And listen to my next phrase. Without the control of family. To share and to develop their own personal goals and dreams and relationships. They need to have time to grow up and face life together. This was the reason for that Old Testament command. And I look back in my own life, and I think of how neat that would have been to have that time, because I had been 20 years old for 5 weeks when I got married. The first thing my father-in-law said when I went to him and asked him if I could marry his daughter was, "Son, how old are you?" Well, I was 19, but that sounded pretty young, so I said, "I'll be 20. That sounded a lot older than 19. And so I was 20, had been 20 for 5 weeks when we got married. And you can believe that it would have been beneficial to my wife if I had had more time or taken more time to focus on our relationship, because she was much more mature than I was. But when you marry somebody that knows everything, what else can you ask for, right? There's also some modern-day wisdom that offers similar advice, and I give this advice to every couple that I have counsel with before their marriage, and that is this, and sometimes parents, if they find out I've given this advice, they're not too happy about it. But I advise them, and I even advise my own daughters the same thing. When you get married, move far enough away from both parents to cross 3 bridges and burn 2 of them. A young married couple needs to have time by themselves to cultivate companionship. And if they don't take that time, then they may not fully enjoy the benefit of marriage that God created as natural benefits of this covenant of companionship that He designed. If for some reason such physical leaving is not possible, then it is possible to, quote, distance yourself while in close proximity to family, but it takes hard work and cooperation. So what happens when a young couple fails to leave and cleave when they marry? Well, here are a few problems that commonly result, and we've all seen them. Number one, in-law interference. You can be a good parent in many respects, but a poor in-law. Let me give you some advice about how to be a good mother or father-in-law. Now, you can go to my sons-in-law and ask them if I fulfill this or not. And I can't promise you what they'll say. But this is my advice to those who are becoming or have become mothers or fathers-in-law. Number one, keep your mouth shut. Number two, don't give any advice unless it's asked for. That's my advice on how to be a good mother and father-in-law. And I know it's hard. It's really difficult to do that. But if you really want to do a favor for your son or your daughter and their spouse, then you need to prepare yourself to do that. In-law interference is one of the most common problems in a young couple's marriage. Granted, much of that interference is out of genuine concern for the happiness and well-being of the couple. After all, as parents, we raise those children, right? And we spent years learning what was best for them. And now that these kids have entered into a marriage, who's better qualified in our mind to advise the kids than their own parents with so many years of valuable marriage experience, right? Wrong. Because even quite often, if that advice is good advice, it's resented. The in-law interference backfires because it can pit the young woman or the young man against their spouse because they have a pulling in two different directions. One may desire to heed the advice of parents, and the other may resist. And there's a very deep principle here that I hope to discuss in later lessons. The desire to please that God put within a child to have the approval of their parent is a really, really powerful force. And if a parent continues to maintain that force in the life of their son or their daughter after they're married, they're asking for problems. God created that need within a child to have their parent's approval. But a parent has to be wise enough to know when it's time to back off of that. You have that child for a certain number of years to train up that child so that they can be a responsible adult. And at some point, it's time for them to fly away from the nest. And it's time for us as parents to allow that to happen. And so one of the things, one of the common problems that can result is in-law interference. And another is not too dissimilar and connected to it is running home to mother. Whenever there's a problem. When a couple lives in close proximity to parents, it's really easy and tempting to run home to mother when there's a problem that comes up. It happens to the bride and it can happen to the groom as well. The pressures of conflict become great in every marriage as we are trying to solve the differences. And I tell young couples whenever we talk together before you married, you think because you love one another so deeply that every difference is not going to matter. Let me give you some advice, some news. Every difference matters. I don't care if it's how you use a toothbrush. Every difference matters, and you're going to have to work every single difference out. Every one of them is going to have to be worked out in some way. And this pressure, conflict, comes with this pressure comes a desire to find somebody who will sympathize with me. And who better than mom and dad? And so we run to mom and dad to get sympathy for what we developed in their home, and certainly we're probably going to find sympathy there. And we just added to the conflict. This does nothing to help the conflict. It merely adds to the problem, subtracts from the respect that should be given between husband and wife, it multiplies the tension, and it further divides the marriage. This is one of the worst things that a person can do in a marriage, and parents need to be mature enough to understand that. One little piece of advice, at least generally, not always absolute, but you'll find yourself doing well if when there's a conflict, you take your spouse, your son or your daughter's spouse aside. You'll find you'll help their marriage out much more. And then there's, briefly, let me comment on the possibility of sibling comparisons. You control the amount of influence that your family has on your marriage. You hear me? You control that. And if you're not controlling it, you need to control it. Because sometimes there are mother-in-laws and father-in-laws who want to inject and insist on injecting themselves into your marriage, and it's going to be your responsibility to to be the one to set the fences for that. That brings problems sometimes when there are siblings who have who are held up as, okay, they have it all together. Why can't you be like your brother? Why can't you be like your sister? Why can't you have a marriage like they have? There are many problems that can arise when newly married couples live close to parents and siblings. God's command to leave and cleave is full of wisdom. There are some things that all newly married couples should glean from this command. You can learn from the examples of others, but do not allow others to interfere in your marriage. If at any time your spouse feels uncomfortable with your parents, then you do what's necessary to alleviate that. Remember, it is your responsibility to leave your parents. You cannot cleave to your spouse until you accomplish that leaving. Do not compare your marriage to anybody else's in your extended family, and don't allow somebody else to do that. Your marriage is made by two unique individuals. Your marriage stands alone. You don't appreciate being measured by somebody else. When somebody compares you unfavorably to someone else, then you don't appreciate that. And nobody else appreciates it when you do that to them either. And so do unto others as you would have them do unto you. There are some common signs that couples exhibit who have achieved this companionship, this desire. There are some things that every couple should strive for. And let me just give you a few of them. One of them is shared hobbies and interests. Finding and developing common interests develops companionship. And by the way, from a practical standpoint, let me say that it has to be something other than shopping. Janice and I have been married for a long time. We went shopping together yesterday, and she informed me that I was not fun to shop with. And I was shocked. Because I didn't know that shopping was supposed to be fun. But find something that you enjoy doing together and spend time doing that. Another sign is that you usually don't see one without the other. That doesn't mean that we don't have time to be with our friends, our wives with their lady friends, and men with their friends. But that time needs to be really, really conservative. And we need to spend much, much, much more time with our families than we do with our friends, because that indicates a problem whenever we'd rather be with our friends than we had our family. I can tell her anything. He knows me better than anyone else. That's a sweet thing, isn't it, when we feel that way in our marriage. That there's nothing that has to be hidden. There's nothing that we even want to hide from our spouses. One of the greatest needs for any marriage is good communication between husband and wife. Couples who develop a relationship where we can freely discuss anything and everything without fear of condemnation or belittlement have achieved great strength in their marriage. And then we protect and defend one another. Something that I had to really work on in my own life, and I still have to work on because of my personality. And that is that we always need to be on one another's side in public. We need to take up for one another. We don't need to criticize. We must not criticize our spouses in front of someone else. There are at least two sources from which a couple will probably have to protect and defend one another. And that is in-laws and, surprisingly, children. In-laws and children. In-laws, I would say, for self-evident truth. Sometimes parents will knowingly or unknowingly put down or otherwise criticize their child's spouse. And when this happens, the companion will defend his spouse to his parents. And secondly, surprisingly, children can also be a source of attack in which a spouse must be defended. Don't always make your husband or your wife be the bad guy so that you can be the good guy. As children grow, the tendency to use parents also grows. And when that happens, the child takes control of the family because they pit the parents against one another. And somehow that comes pre-wired. Every child tries to do that. And if the parents are not aware enough or don't care enough about that, then it turns out that the child takes over the family. They run the family. The companion couple will always appear united in their decisions. And when there is a disagreement, you won't have that disagreement in front of the child. You'll have it somewhere and work it out. And then whenever you're there with your child, you will have a united front. Children should often hear, "Well, let me check that out with your mom and we'll decide and we'll let you know later. Let me check it out with your dad and I'll get back to you with that." And that presents a united front. The defense and protection offered by this united front will enhance your marriage and your family and the security of your child greatly. It's such a shame that we don't have the opportunity to have a trial run on marriage and child rearing, isn't it? So we can find out where the pitfalls are for ourselves and we can come back and do it right. We don't get to have a practice run. It's the real deal right out of the bat. It's real life. It's actuality. And the consequences happen even if our mistakes were out of ignorance. The consequences are just as real as if we had deliberately done it. And so we have to get smart fast. We have to grow up. We have to look at what God said it takes to have a successful marriage and home and dedicate ourselves to doing that. We have to get it right the first time. The most beautiful relationship in this world is that companionship, covenant of companionship. It's an incredibly beautiful thing when two people listen to God and follow it, and they develop over time. It takes time to develop that kind of relationship. But it's an incredibly beautiful thing. And we know a few people who've done it right, don't we? A few people who've listened to what the Lord said and they've done it right. And it's one of the most beautiful things in the world to see a family in harmony, isn't it? Maybe you've made some mistakes in your life. And maybe you need God's help. If you recognize that, I can tell you this. Denying it is not going to help your situation. Putting off changing what you know needs to be changed is not going to help it. It's just going to make it worse. The Lord teaches us. We all come to points in our life on different things that we realize, boy, I need to change. I need to change some things in my life. And God is gracious to allow us to know that before it's too late, isn't it? While we can still do something about it. And what would keep us from changing the things in our life? And I will say to all of us, including me, there are some things that we need to change, aren't there? There are some things that I need to change in my life. And the Lord has graciously given me the opportunity and the time to do that. And if you need the Lord's help, if you need prayers from brothers and sisters, for the strength to help right wrongs that you've been a part of in your relationship, then that's what we're as family here for. Not to judge one another, but to rejoice whenever somebody recognizes, I need some help in this thing of marriage. I need to become a better father, a better husband, a better wife. And if you feel a need for the prayers of brothers and sisters to help you improve your home, won't you come while we stand and sing?